Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. Same news as last time out, I'm going on vacation. Going on a long holiday in Africa, around lots of different countries in Africa, Kenya, Nairobi. We're going from Nairobi down to Johannesburg, taking 5 weeks overland truck and camping and safari tour and things like that. So if I am not around for the next 5 weeks or something like that, if you don't get any more podcasts, don't worry about it. I'm not dead. Just on vacation. If you want to, you can probably follow along maybe with my blog. I'm going to put a link to my girlfriend's blog. We're going on there as well. So if you want to keep up with some of the travels, I have loaded up something like 7 different audiobooks to read, and I have a few ebooks to read, audiobooks to listen to, ebooks to read as I go around. My girlfriend just bought herself a new iPad, iPad 2, specifically for ebook reading and, you know, not having to take chunky laptops and things like that. Otherwise, in 5 weeks' time or so, check out the. I'll do lots of reviews in a row. I'll be uploading lots of reviews in a row. I don't think I'll be doing many along the way. Or if I do them along the way, probably not so much chance to upload them. I'm not sure how great the internet connection is. I've been to Tanzania before, and the internet connection there was probably the worst internet connection I've ever tried to use anywhere in the world. Such is the digital divide, I guess that's what you call it. Anyway, I'm going to get on to today's review. It's Blue Remembered Earth by Alistair Reynolds, and I have no notes in front of me. I did have some notes, but I made too many notes in the previous few podcast reviews, and I want to keep the length of this podcast down a bit because I've really have been going a bit long with these other ones. So I'm just sitting here looking at Audacity on my computer screen and just seeing the waveform creating in front of me. No notes at all. Although I will now bring up the Goodreads.com page. So Blue Remembered Earth, hardcover, 212 pages, published 2012, January 2012. So it's a brand new book. I think it's not been published in America yet. It's only been published here in Europe. I've sort of seen this on different websites and things. Actually, mostly on Alistair Reynolds' blog, because he's quite an interesting blogger. So I like seeing his updates. And he says, yeah, it's coming out soon, whatever. And I was around at the science fiction bookshop, which is quite close to my house. I'd gone there with my girlfriend because she was wanting to show me the Perry Rhodan books, or I was wanting to show her them, because we were searching for ebooks before, and every single book in the top of the science fiction chart on iBooks is Perry Rhodan, and all of the audiobooks are all Perry Rhodan ones. I say all of them, like there's thousands of these things. It's one of the biggest science fiction series ever, only in Germany. Anyway, so we were checking out some of that, and I saw Blue Remembered Earth had come out already, so I thought, well, I'll buy it. And then I thought, no, wait a second, there'll be a version on Audible. So I got my iPhone out and checked. It's great, we're living in a science fiction future. I just checked the Audible app on my phone and said that, yeah, it was available. So while I was in the bookshop, I actually bought the audiobook version from Audible. Or I spent one of my credits on Blue Remembered Earth. And when I got home, it downloaded automatically, or whatever happened. Anyway, I listened to it, and it's really good. I say it's really good. It's a good book. Let me get into it. Let's set this out. It's not set in any of Alistair Reynolds' previous world. He's best known for his Revelation Space kind of world, which is an interesting kind of noir, gothic, science fiction, no faster than light space travel, but sort of wide galaxy, almost galaxy spanning culture of humans, and there's other non-human life forms which are not intelligence. Humans are the only intelligence, or the only intelligence we can understand, but there's lots of other stuff going on there as well, lots of other sort of alien artifacts and things that you might think are alien artifacts, and, you know, very interesting, well-conceived world, amazingly conceived world. I've reviewed these books before as well. I think I actually reviewed Revelation Space and some others set in that same universe, and it's like a long history. And of course it's a long history because it's set out. And then there was another one, these House of Suns, which I really enjoyed. I reviewed that too. I think Alistair Reynolds is probably one of my most reviewed authors here on the podcast, which was interesting. And what was it? Oh, Terminal World. That was set in another world as well. Lots of stuff taking place on on a planet in the future, and you're not quite sure what planet it is. It's Mars. But all that kind of stuff. Now, this is all a whole new world setup, and I knew straight away that it was going to be a first book in a series, because it's called right there on the front cover. It goes book one of the Poseidon's Children. Now, reading this book, I'm not quite sure who Poseidon is or who Poseidon's children will be. I guess it's the humans. But there's lots of other things that we can think about here in the book, who Poseidon is. So it's set in... let me see if I can find something. So I guess it's set around about, what, like 2150, 2160? You know, maybe 150 years into the future. And the action starts in Africa, in Tanzania, in the shadow of Mount Kilimanjaro. And we have this young girl and young guy, boy and girl, Jeffrey and Sunday. And Jeffrey and Sunday have a very famous and very important grandmother that they don't know very much about, because they've never really met her, because she lives in seclusion in what's called the Ice Palace, which is a space station which is orbiting the moon. So it starts out as them as kids, and then we skip forward after the prologue and they're grown up, and now Sunday is living on the moon. And Jeffrey is studying elephants in the Serengeti, or round about that area, where I'm going to be going next week. On Tuesday, I'll be there. Anyway, so it's the world that is set in, these guys are living in, is kind of almost a utopian society. And it reminded me a little bit of what I just read a few books ago, with Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom by Cory Doctorow, that it's not so much that nobody dies and that you're backing up your memories all the time. Nothing like that is quite there. But everyone seems to be looked after. Everyone has enough to eat. There's not any crime. Because if there is crime, everything there's 100% surveillance of all things. And everyone has these implants in their brains. So if they're going to be violent against someone, they can't be violent against it. And if someone wants to do something bad, well, if they get away with it, Everyone can look back through those records. So there's 100% surveillance on Earth and throughout the human civilization that's spreading across the solar system, except in what they call the unsurveilled zones. Actually, I can't really remember what they call these certain zones, but on the moon, there is a place where, hey, what we want to do here is actually not have any surveillance, and we want to ferment a low level of crime. So if you're going around that area, you might get pickpocketed, or you might get a very low level of crime, which is allowed, but there isn't any surveillance. Your people get away with it. And they say, that's part, you know, that low level bubbling of crime is part of the human condition. And if we don't have that, if we're too cosseted, we won't be able to, grow as a human species. So what I want to say here, yeah, this book is very much a setting the scene kind of book about the setting. I've just mentioned these two little places, one place in the African plains and the other place up on the moon. But throughout the course of this book, people go on journeys. Sunday goes to Mars and back, and Jeffrey goes up to the moon and back down again and under the ocean. And this is one of the strengths of the book, I think, is that because it is like a travelogue. It is like, hey, go over here and check out this, and go over here and check out this cool bit of architecture, and go over here and check out this cool bit of, you know, technology, and go over here and check out this landscape, and go over here and check out this canyon on Mars, and this hill on Mars, and this thing on Phobos, and this bit of the moon, and go down under the ocean and see what's under the ocean. And there's a whole civilization. Because the world is sort of like split into two different political kind of factions. The people who are living on the Earth, I mean, when I say on the Earth, I mean on dry ground. And then there's these other faction, this other whole kind of parallel civilization of people who have modified their bodies to live underneath the sea. So they become mermen and mermaids, that kind of thing. And there's a whole undersea civilization growing up about all the resources that can be found under the sea, because, you know, this is, you know, there's not a lot of oil left, and there's not a lot of this left, and there's not a lot of that left, and people are trying to be, you know, very green, even though the sea levels are rising. They've put around, you know, these big seawalls around the place. So this is a very, very well realized world. Like, the politics has been worked out, and the technology has been worked out, and the cultural ramifications have been worked out, which I found very interesting to read. However, for a setting, for a what's trying to be like a fast-paced kind of thriller mystery kind of story, I didn't find it that satisfying. Because when you're living in a world where crime doesn't happen or crime doesn't exist, the worst action, you know, the worst things that can happen is like someone can try and hit you and then they fall over because their brains are turned off when they try and hit you. It doesn't create a huge amount of tension. And when politically everything is very, very stable, you're thinking, well, what's really the problem here? If anything happens, there's not going to be any wars or anything like that. And the whole book is about, you know, humans sort of getting past all of these petty differences and the technology and the that is needed to get there and the cultural advances that are needed to move on to that sort of next stage of not human evolution, but sort of like cultural development or international relations kind of development. And this is sort of played out, you know, both on the moon, and we see these different political systems. You got one on the moon, which is this one way, and you get the people underneath the ocean who live in another way, and there's other things. So the so that's the world, which is, like I say, very interesting to read about, but felt for me a little bit empty in the terms of what it added to the drama, even though I really enjoyed all of the different places that we go to. And because this is a very much a scene setting kind of book, that's what most of the book is, traveling different places and seeing them. That's great, if that's what you want from a book. I wanted a bit more, and for the story that we got, the setting didn't really make it that much more interesting than it could have been with some stronger settings, or letting the settings play more into the story rather than just the themes, because the themes are very strong. Let's get it onto the story then. We got this world, and you're thinking, well, where can the drama come from? So what we do is we get the news that Sunday and Jeffrey's grandmother has died, and what happens is a family reunion of this very large, sort of like sprawling dynasty, and they sort of almost own all of the outer solar system, because this is an important world building point, that there's robots, but robot technology or artificial intelligence levels are kept artificially low. And it's sort of hinted at that there's something happened in the past where some artificial intelligence sort of maybe ran out of control, but now there are these rules in place that you can't have elaborate artificial intelligences. You can get it to you can have an artificial intelligence which is so, but not too powerful. It can't be self-directing. It can't be given a kind of a robot body and go out and do its own will. But what this family, the Akinia family, has done is sent out these robots across the whole of the solar system, and these robots mindlessly mine the solar system and send raw materials back to the inner solar system. That's the idea. So this is so all of the family members are spread out throughout the solar system. Some are on Saturn, and some are on Mars, and some are on the Moon, and I can't remember if people go to Venus, but it's not really mentioned that much. So what happens is that most of the family members gather back together again, but the people who can't get back together, they just send their robot proxies, the golems, these little robot things where you can put in your own personality file if you're too far away, and the speed of light means that you can't control it directly. Or if you're just in moon orbit or on the moon, you can sort of do the telepresence kind of thing with the robot body as your proxy. Really cool idea. So all of these family members get together for this family reunion at the funeral of the grandmother. So what happens then is you're thinking, well, where's the story really going to start? Sunday and Jeffrey have got these cousins, which when I was reading, listening to this audiobook, they always came up in my head as sort of like the Winklevoss brothers from the Facebook story. What was it called? The Social Network. It's those two guys, really. They're the sort of like the alpha males of the family. They're the ones who are really running things. You know, Jeffrey is looking after elephants and Sunday's trying to be an artist. But these guys are really the ones in charge. I think they're going to be the ones in charge now that grandmother has died. And there's some unfinished business. There's something that's been left in a safety deposit box. And they say, hey, Jeffrey, can you go up and get this thing? Because we think, you know, you were grandmother's, one of grandmother's favorites. Actually, I can't remember the reason why they send him, except not do it himself. But anyway, he goes up to the moon and opens this thing. Lucas, what was that? I can't remember the names of the Lucas and... Of course, I remember the name Lucas. Jeffrey is the other one. Lucas and something. Someone. Hector. Hector, that was it. Hector and Lucas are the cousins of Jeffrey and Sunday. Those are another two of the main characters in the book. So he goes off there, and what starts, and then I realize, oh, what the story is really going to be about is this weird game that the dead grandmother is playing with the descendants. And it's like, hey, I found this, and inside was a clue that led us to this. And then once you got that clue, then you go somewhere else and it led to this. And then when you get that clue, you led to... And this is like most of the book is Jeffrey and or Sunday going from place to place around the moon, around the solar system, over to Mars and things like that, trying to find the next clue. Unfortunately, I didn't find this very satisfying as the main driving point in the plot, because, well, it's like why didn't Grandma just put the answer to the first or to the last clue in the same place that she put the first clue or where she put the first riddle? Why didn't she just put the answer to it right there? And I'm thinking, that's why doesn't she? If she wants to send us some information, which should only be allowed to be passed on after she's died, why didn't she just put it there and tell them about it while it's died? And it was really weird that at some point in the story, one of the characters actually says that. It says, well, why are we going through all these steps? Why didn't she just put the answer in the safety deposit box? Why do we have to go from place to place to place to place to place to find all these different answers to these different questions? Which was a very strange thing for like Alistair Reynolds to point out one of the main flaws in the story. Although it wasn't a flaw, but it was one of the main problems at this point, because you're getting halfway through the book and you're like, when is the story really going to start? When is something bad going to happen that's going to force our characters to do something? When are we going to get that really like thing that we care about? Because it's just like, oh, we've got to do this. We've got to find it. Why? Well, we've got to do this. And it became clear quite near the beginning that this was actually a test, that grandmother wasn't around to see her children grow up, but if they manage to get through and find all these clues and are clever enough to do all of that, it's a test of character. And at the end of this long thing, the person whose character has been tested is going to be given a problem to solve, or a bit of responsibility, let me put it that way. They're going to be given some responsibility. And that then, because they've managed to get through all these clues, that she knows that they're the person who is more responsible, or something like that. It turns out that idea that I had right near the beginning, once I realized, oh, this is going to be about a series of clues, and you know, once you get to the second clue, you're thinking, oh, this is just going to be clues all the way down. It's going to be turtles all the way down. And that's what it is. And I realized that. And then you get to the end of the book, that is what happens. So then I was thinking, okay, so thinking about this, what will be the thing that they have to be given control of at the end of the book? The Sunday and or Jeffrey, whoever gets there, they're going to be given something to do. They're going to be given a task to do, and it's awesome. They're going to have a secret revealed to them. And as I read through it, around about halfway through, I thought, well, I know what it's going to be. It's going to be the. I mean, I don't know. It's weird because I want to say it now, but it'll be a bit of a spoiler if I do. But there's going to be some kind of, like I say, new technology, which has probably got to do with an engine. And you know, well, I say an engine, a star drive kind of thing, because that's what the book is about, kind of, you know, that's what it is. Blue remembered Earth. It's about people who don't remember Earth anymore because they're too far away. Well, that's not the people in Mars orbit, is it? Because they can still see it. Maybe the people in Saturn, maybe further out. And when you get to the end of the book, you're just like, well, yeah, I know this was going to happen because a thing on Mercury, we said that they were doing this on Mercury and this thing that here and that thing there. And I realized the main problem with this book for me about the story of this book is that I'm quite used to reading Alistair Reynolds' novels. I think I've read all of his novels, you know, and I think the only things that I've not read by him has been the short story collection called Galactic North that I've not read. And I know all of his other stories. And I know that his stories are so tightly plotted that he never puts anything into the story unless it's going to be used later. Nothing goes in there. Everything is done. And it would be a criticism, but he does it so well. It's like clockwork. Every single thing, every little tooth of a cog that goes round, it's going to come round again and it's going to play into the end. So every time that you see something which isn't being used, even though this is like a novel which is setting the scene for a series, you know that everything that sort of like a character notices will come in later. Every character, one of the characters, and every sort of like supporting character that any of the characters meet, you know that they're going to play a major part in the plot, or probably will play a major part in the book. Every fact that is brought up about someone's history is going to be important. Every artifact that is found, every monument, every thing that is referenced, every gift, every elephant, every this, all of that, everything is going to come back together again. So as I'm reading it, I'm going, well, I know this is an Alistair Reynolds book, so I just have to put together these different bits and pieces. And I was wondering how all of the people in the novel, how all the characters in the novel didn't get it. I mean, they were living in this world and they were noticing all this stuff. And I was like, this is really obvious what's going on here. It's going to be this, 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 and this. And I was waiting for Alistair Reynolds to surprise me with this book. Unfortunately, he didn't surprise me, but the characters were surprised. And when I was just talking about this with my girlfriend a few days ago when I finished it, I was like, yeah, the characters didn't know that they were in an Alistair Reynolds novel. Because if they did, they'd have paid attention to all of the things that they'd seen. There is nothing that they're going to see which isn't going to be important to the big revelation at the end of the book. And there wasn't anything, you know, the thing that they found on Phobos, that was important. The thing that we heard about in Mercury, that was important. The Winter Palace, that was important. The elephants, they were important. The map, all of this was important. Every person that they met was important in some way along. The guy that was living at home, he was important. What was his name? Mercedes? No, something like that. I can't remember the guy's name. This guy, he's going to be important. That woman, we heard about her, she's going to be important. This fact, this character that they didn't know who it's going to be, well, that's going to be someone who's really important as well. Everything that comes back, and I know it's like a weird criticism to make, but I didn't want such a tightly, not because it wasn't even tightly plotted. We were given lots of information, and then at the end, we were told stuff that happened, like that we had information revealed to us when the characters arrived at a destination at the end of all this long line of clues and were told something by someone and given all of the answers. Unfortunately, I'd already worked out most of the answers, and there were a few little things which I knew would be involved, which I didn't know how they would be involved, and then I was told how they were involved in this answers. And it was just sort of made me go, okay. Because there was so much to like about this. There was so much going on. Like, all the characters were interesting, the technology was interesting, the setting was interesting. The story, not very interesting. And the things that were at stake... Oh, yeah, this is what I was telling you about before, that I was wanting to mention before. I'm going without notes here, so this might be a little bit more rambling. But, like I say, Cory Doctorow wrote a story, and it was like, well, if you're living in a utopia and nobody dies and nobody does anything like this and there's no crime and all that kind of stuff, what's there to write a story about? And he's like, well, I'll write a story about a fairground ride at Disneyland. And I'm like, fucking great. Is that it? Is that the best you can do? Is that the real driving force of it? And it's like, well, yeah, because in a utopia where everyone's happy, there's no real conflict. So you have to have like a fairground ride as the main thing, the most important thing in the world. Now, most of the way through this book, that's what this felt like. I'm like, well, why are they running around on this game? Why don't they just go, well, actually, no, because it's good life at the moment. We don't need to do that. But as you go through the book, you realize there's these wider scopes. There's some people going, oh, well, we want to do the, we're the panspermium initiative, so we want to spread life throughout the entire galaxy. And other people are going, really? Is that what's... And, you know, the Chinese are going, well, we're going for the long view. We're going to send out the Chinese and we're going to spread throughout the stars. And then the Poseidon people, not the Poseidon people, but you know, the sub-aqua lands, they've got their own things going on, and the people on the moon have got their own things going on, and then this company and the Kenya company, they've got all their own different ideas that they're wanting to do, and they're wanting to try out long term. So you realize that there is something wider at stake here, but not for the characters involved. It doesn't seem like there's anything bad, and when characters do die, well, they can't die from anyone being violent, so they mainly just die by accident. And in some of the ways that they do die by accident is really, I found really interesting. The reason why one of the characters gets killed by the elephants, I thought was very, very clever, on a story level and a thematic level, which I'll get to later. But, well, actually, let's get to it now. This is what I'm trying to say. There is something that's very important. And this was the test of character kind of stuff that I was talking about before, and also how far society has moved on and how far culture has moved on and how more civilized we're going to get. If we're going to be given a big secret at the end of the novel, which is so powerful, it's like, is humanity ready to deal with this responsibility? And the person who goes through this series of tests is going to be the person who's going to represent the best of humanity and is going to be the one who decides what's going on. And you think, well, why didn't the grandmother check that? But then, like, around about a quarter of the way through the novel, you're like, oh, I realize why the grandmother can't check that. I don't want to spoil it, but it's really obvious why not. And so that's what this book is around. On a thematic level, the book is around about, like, how far will humanity have to go, or how far will humanity have to mature before it can not just take responsibility for its own future, but take responsibility for the future of take responsibility for the galaxy or for the stars, or not just for its own future, but the future of everything. The future of life, the future, because they're not just going to spread human life throughout the galaxy. The Panspermium Initiative are wanting to spread, you know, elephant life and plant life and dogs and cats and all things can be spread throughout the galaxy, not just humans. And so that's what the main thing is around about. But you really only find out about that final quandary in the last chapter. So what has been at stake is, in fact, the future of the entire galaxy, if humans are the only ones around, or the entire future of the human race, or will the human race abuse this new technology or this new secret and then, you know, destroy themselves, or will they live through it and go on and stuff? So there is actually a huge amount at stake throughout this book, but we as the readers don't find out about it unless you sort of read into it, until the last chapter, which, like I say, it's quite unsatisfying when you get to the very end of the book and you realize that, oh, all this time, this was going to be really important, because if Lucas and, Lucas and Hector get to this secret, you know, humanity is going to go in one direction, but if Jeffrey or Sunday get this bit of secret first, it's going to go in another direction, or it could go in another direction, which is kind of hinted at. And maybe I wasn't meant to work that out really early on in the book. Maybe it was meant to be a big reveal. But if it is going to be the big reveal, what am I trying to say here? If the big payoff at the end of the novel is like, hey, everything that happened up until now that you thought wasn't that important is actually really important, that's unsatisfying up until the point when you find that out, if you haven't already worked it out. But if I have already worked it out, and that's the revelation at the end, I actually want something more. I want something bigger. I want something that I haven't worked out, that they're developing a star drive from Mercury or whatever it's going to be. And then you're just sort of going to have a character at the end of the novel just fill me in on all the details that I haven't worked out so far, but broad swathe. You know, so it's a weird thing that if you work it out in advance, it's not very satisfying when you get to the end. And if you don't work it out until you get to the end, the rest of the novel, all the journey to get there, hasn't been very satisfying at all. So there we go about the plot. Oh, one other plot point that I have to remember is that if at one point you discover that a character who everybody who thinks has died isn't actually dead and they just faked their own death and now they actually meet them again, we can't believe that anybody else is actually dead unless we see them die in front of us. And as it happens, again, kind of a spoiler, but it sort of like, if you bring someone back to life that easily, it makes me think, well, what about this character that we've heard has died but we didn't see died? That person's probably not dead either. And how about this person over here who we've just heard has died but we never actually saw died? Maybe that person's not dead either. And how about this person over here that we heard has died and is, but we didn't actually see their dead body, you know, being crushed in front of us by a foot of an elephant slash robot, or an elephant robot, or robotic elephant? Yeah, so that's a bit weird. And I don't want to give it away, but, like, I think most of the characters who die aren't actually dead. Again, spoilers there, but it's, like, really annoying when you read that kind of thing. Anything else about the story? No, I can't think of anything. So, characters. The characters are interesting. I actually quite like Jeffrey, who is our main viewpoint character. He has a lot of interesting things going on. I didn't make any notes about it, but he does go on a very interesting journey, and not just sort of like physically, but, you know, developmentally. He starts off and he doesn't want to have anything to do with the family business, and then slowly, like, there's all these clues that he's got to find, and his cousins Lucas and Hector sort of cajoling him into doing stuff. It does make him grow as a human and as a person, and it's really interesting at the end that not at the end, but like part of the way through, when Hector or Lucas, I can't remember which one it is suddenly like, yeah, is it, well, why are you asking me now? He's like, well, now you're not working for us, you're working against us. Now I can consider you and treat you as an equal. And I really love that. And I'm like, yeah, go Jeffrey, you've got it. And then, of course, Hector and Lucas, they've got their own trajectory as characters. Sunday, I thought, was the least interesting character, which is a pity because we do spend quite a bit of time with her. She goes to Mars and stuff. And all the time that we're there, I'm just like, well, what is she really doing? And then she's got this love interest, this her husband or something. And he's again, one of those characters where he's tagging along and suddenly he pops up again. I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot he was here. And it seems a bit strange that at some point Sunday also has that same kind of thing. It's like, oh, you're still here? And he's like, yeah, I'm here. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, come along then. He's like, oh, okay. So that's a bit of a weird relationship. But I really do like all of the family dynamics that play out here, especially between the brother and sister, and between the cousins, but, you know, all the way through like that way, you know, all the way that they all think, well, I thought my grandmother was like this, or what, I had this view of my grandmother, and my grandmother was doing this and that, so that's interesting. But again, a lot of the more interesting characters, which are the ones that I thought was more interesting, were some of the smaller characters. I was like, well, in the second book in the series, I hope we follow this character. Or I hope we follow this kind of character. Some of the prospectors on Mars, I found them interesting. There's a character they meet there, which I would really love to read his backstory. And I know that Alistair Reynolds sometimes does do backstory, like the prefect was set in the Revelation Space universe, set in the Glitter Belt. The Glitter Belt was the Glitter Belt before it was called the Rust Belt, of all the broken down spaceships orbiting a planet. But before they were all broken down spaceships, it was called the Glitter Belt. And I really like that you're reading a book and you think, wow, I know that at the end of this is all going to end really badly with the melding plague, and I'm not quite sure where it's going to go. So I'd like to actually read some of the backstory of some of these characters. The grandmother, what was her name? Anis? Ennis? Something like that. Super interesting, obviously, but absent for most of the book. Except we do get what's called the Construct. Now, in Revelation Space, if you read that, one of the characters is sort of comes back, and, well, doesn't really come back, but after he dies, they collect together everything, all of the records that they have of his, all of his conversations, everything that's known about him, and they create sort of this autobiography. But the autobiography isn't a text document that you read through. It's actually like a construct, like an artificial intelligence, but based purely on the memories and the experiences of someone who's died, and they get together all of the information and put it through some algorithms, and it spits out some kind of artificial intelligence. Now, in this universe, artificial intelligence isn't really allowed, but they do have these constructs of the grandmother's character. I can't really remember what else I wanted to say about that. But she's there, and she's an interesting character, and I'd like to actually read a little bit more about her backstory to see what made her get to there. It's like, well, her story has to be more interesting than these guys, because all of these guys' stories came from her ideas. She set up the entire story of this book. So if she is good enough to set up the entire story that takes place in this book, I want to read what made her into that person to get her to be that person who is able to do that. I'm waffling now. So what else do I like about this book? Oh, the technology in this book. That's really good. So you've got this surveillance society, the de-scrutinized zone on the moon. That was the place that we're going to go for. And you've got like this big, multivac mechanism kind of computer, which is keeping tabs on everyone, keeping an eye on everyone. So that's an interesting thing. But even just the technology, the different technologies that they get in the different places, I really enjoy the submarines underneath the sea and these sort of like waterways. Even though it did seem a bit trivial after I read that, I was like, well, why did we read all of that? It didn't really play into the thematic ideas of the book so much, or the story. Sometimes you just arrive somewhere. And one of the ideas that I really enjoyed was the part of the moon which is set aside. I think, I can't remember what it was called. It was called the Evolvarium or something. And all of these robots live there, and they're all competing, and they're sort of rebuilding themselves and reforging themselves and creating new parts of themselves in this interesting way. And these human prospectors, they're going down there to find new intellectual property that the robots try and make. So if a self-evolving robot makes a new kind of mechanism, or a new kind of transport, or a new body shape, or anything like that, these guys go down, get a copy of it, find a copy of it, or do something like that, and then sell that new idea to a technology company who can then use that improvement, that sort of like evolutionary, no, what is it called, like naturally selected improvement of some mechanical design into their designs, which is really interesting. What else do I like about that? Some stuff I can't even remember. Oh yeah, like I said before about the golems and the transmission of personality, the telepresence, the advanced telepresence that's going around. There is of course the star drives and the moon and Mars kind of stuff. What else? I can't even remember what else I was wanting to say about this. I'm sure there was other technology there, but I really do like the level of technology. But it did feel sometimes a little bit strange. It's like some things were there because because it was needed for the plot, and other things weren't there because it would have made the plot too clunky. Like the whole, we're not allowed to have artificial intelligences. It's like, well, that would have been cool if you could have them, but sometimes it seemed a little bit contrived. It wasn't a story about that, but it was like, in the Dune universe, they say, okay, no thinking machines, and it's a very hard line, and it makes the world timeless in a way when you read Dune, and the no technology, or the, not the no technology, the no computer technology sort of like levels out all of society and levels out all of the different all of the different houses and factions, and it's just like, well, how clever you are. And it's, okay, who's the most clever is going to get through this? In this book, the level of technology gets to that point. It's like, well, who has the best technology is going to win. But it can't be that good, because otherwise these guys over here will obviously win because they've got the better technology. So it does seem to, like, the characters who obviously aren't that clever, or aren't as clever as me, or aren't as clever as a reader of Alistair Reynolds' novels, they don't seem to, work out what's going on. But I'm thinking, well, why don't you just get this better technology over here? I'm not really sure. What's going on? What else have I got to say here? Oh, the writing is very good. Alistair Reynolds can write, but like I say, sometimes it seems a bit too clean. All of the things, it's just like, well, this is going to happen over here, this is going to happen over here. Like even I just said before about the Evolvarium on Mars. You think it would have been really good if that was just a backdrop, or just a setting, but no, it suddenly has to have plot significance later on, or character significance later on. I was like, well, can't you just make it interesting? But then you think, but if it was just, I'd mentioned this before, but if it was just an interesting location, you'd think that didn't have much to do with the plot. So it's this really strange balance that he's almost striking behind everything in the book has to have meaning and plot significance and character significance, or is it just setting? And I really like this setting of so much of this. That was what I was saying about this, the writing, is that there's these really good sections where he just sets the scene, and he really makes you think about, you're really in the future. And it's like, what we'll do is just we'll just have a rundown. So someone goes to Mars and they've been sleeping for 5 weeks to get there. So they have to catch up on the news, all the news that they missed. And they look at the gossip columns and it's like, well, this person's done this and this person's done this. And there's this this star has, you know, married this person, this star. And there's this star who has who got divorced from the clone of himself. And I was like, oh, that's really clever. And it's just a line that's dropped in there, but so it really does establish the future really well. Another point, someone is looking around a room, an old room. It's like, wow, and there's this over here, and there's this lighting fixture up there, and there's a bed over there, and there's this furniture made out of wood. Who would make it out of wood? And not the old fashioned kind of wood where it grows that way, but wood that's actually been carved down to this, not grown up into that shape. And there's so much stuff there which is really cool. Another writing decision that I knew was going to be in this book slightly, because I read Alistair Reynolds' blog, is that he was when he was writing this, he was posting some different research bits and pieces. And he was saying that, hey, checking out the American long-range bomber strategy is still with the B-52 bombers or whatever, you know, or what, I can't remember what the fleet is, but stuff that, the same bombers that were used just after the end of the Second World War is still there. The 747 plane, of course, you still build new ones, but the 747's been around since the 1960s, and yet, 50 years later, we're still flying around with the same design of aeroplane. And it was another one that the guy who worked on the very first rockets with Goddard or something also worked on the Harrier jump jet prototype. So you're thinking, wow, this guy was making planes when planes were first flying, you know, when aviation was brand new, and then he was still around years later. And he's like, well, lots of technology moves really, really quickly, but other technology, if it works, just sort of hangs around. It's just still being used. All these boats are still being used many, many years later. All these planes, you know, once the design works, well, we'll just stick with that design. And I do like the ideas that he brings in with the technology again, of bringing in these old bits of technology where you think, well, why are they using that? And then you think, well, why not still be using that? So we do get like someone flying around in a Cessna, and of course the Cessna in this is only 100 years old, but most people are flying around in brand new kind of aircrafts, and he's flying around in a Cessna around Africa. And I was like, well, yeah, maybe a small plane like that is still the best way to get around. So that's a cool thing. I'm just gonna open up Audible here because I want to check out the name of the narrator of this, and let me just bring it up here in my thing. Blue Remembered Earth. So narrated by Cobner Holbrook Smith. I've never heard a book of his before, but it was really, really good. He's a really, really good narrator. The voices that he's a British narrator, and that works well, you know, with the whole Kenyan kind of stuff, because everyone's got a bit of, you know, an educated African accent, which is a British accent, I guess, if you want to call it that way. But the different voices that he puts on for the different characters is sometimes so subtly done. But then you've got the Winklevoss brothers, Lucas and Hector, and one of the voices, he just, oh no, I'm going to be like this, you know, I'm going to, and again, a really, really great voice performance for this. I would give him 5 stars out of 5. Let me click on his name here on Audible. Let's see if he's done some other books as well. Can't really see. Rivers of London, Moon Over Soho. Yeah, obviously other London-based or, you know, British books. That's what he does. He's only done a few books, but I would definitely listen to him doing other science fiction books for sure. What else do you want to say there? Yeah, the writing. It's very good. He does good descriptions. He does good character, interesting dialogue. Sometimes it is a bit like, oh, I've got to now portray this much information over the next 4 pages. Let's cram it all in. So sometimes it's a bit strange, but it is a book about people finding stuff out and asking questions of other people and trying to get information from them. So I do understand that that will be a function of quite a lot of the writing. Which is, I think, maybe I'll end there. I don't really have a whole lot more to say about it. Gone 42 minutes already. Normally I finish off talking about the themes, but I really went into that a bit earlier on because it is a bit clunky. It's like, will we as a human race be able to take responsibility for ourselves and have the power to see that responsibility through? And that's what the whole book seemed to be leading up to. And then that question was answered in the end. I don't want to give away how well it is answered. I guess that is the points that he's addressing here. So there we go. That's going to be my review. I'm going to give this, in conclusion, if this was a book which wasn't written by Alistair Reynolds, I'd say, wow, this is a really good book. Loads of really good ideas, interesting characters, great setting and stuff like that. The story not that strong, but, you know, let's see this author's next book and we'll see how it goes. But it's Alistair Reynolds, and it's not like I expect more from him, because what I expect from him is this, but I really wanted a bit more of a focused plot, a bit more of a, hey, here's a big problem, let's solve this problem, here's something that we care about, let's try and work it out. I think he's got to the point where he's got lots of ideas for characters, and he's got lots of ideas for setting and technology and all the stuff that you really want from a science fiction book. But I really do hope he picks up a bit in terms of the storylines again. All of his stories are always really complex and dense and plot like information heavy, and you've got to pay attention, and you know, you got to see how it all comes out at the end, rinses out at the end. But I really sort of long for those much more, you know, plots, maybe just a world where I can care more about it. You know, even it seemed a bit strange in Terminal World how one of the main characters was sort of meandering around at one point. And as a reader, I'm thinking, what's going on? And then he's told, hey, you're not the main character in this story. This isn't your story. It's this person over here. It's actually their story. And then you're like, oh, and then suddenly it all picks up again. And you're like, right, okay, now I get where it's going. Now I see where it's going. And he seems to do that a few times in different stories where you say, okay, I'm not really quite sure where it's going, and then like a third of the way through, suddenly it picks up and accelerates like from quite early on all the way through to the end. And in this book, he just never had that. And I really, really wanted it a bit more. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. Don't start here if you're reading Alistair Reynolds. Start off with something like Revelation Space or one of those other series. You know, Terminal World is a good one if you like airships. But this seems to be a bit too, what did I put on my, let me look at my goodreads.com thing here. I made some in, as I was going along, I always put different status updates. So I said, when I was at 75%, I said, I have a feeling, oh no, what is it? No, it's 50%. I said, unless the story properly picks up, I think this might be considered low-level Reynoldian material. And yeah, that is actually what it is. It's sort of like low-level stuff. It's nothing bad. It's no crystal... What is it called? Century Rain. It's not Century Rain. It's not really, really bad, but it's no... It's no like The Prefect, which was really, really... In fact, I think I only gave The Prefect 4 stars, or maybe 4.5 stars. But you know, a lot of his other books are like really, really good. And this one is like, oh, it's okay, but like... a bit of a better story would have been nice, but it wasn't that big. You know, it's not that long as an audiobook. I got through it quite easily. Well, it's 21 hours, so I guess it is quite a big chunky book, but it's a very brisk read. He certainly pulls you through the story quickly, but it never really kind of got going. It never really pushed me through. It was always like, yeah, okay, let's get to it. Here we go. And never really made me go, oh, this is awesome. So 3.5 stars. That's all he's going to get this time out. That's it for me. Email me, luke@juggler.net. I'm going to be traveling, so I might not get back to you with the emails, but I always do reply to every email, so even if it takes me a long time. Recommend some books. I've got 2 more Audible credits that I've got to spend, and I'll have probably a lot of opportunities to listen to audiobooks in this next 5 weeks as I'm traveling quite a bit. So send me your recommendations by email, luke@juggler.net. You can follow me on goodreads.com, keep up to date with my reading. You can read my blog, keep up to date with my travel, photography, and videos, and writing, and everything goes there on my blog. That's lukeburridge.com. Click on blog. And you can read my own bits of writing if you go to lukeburridge.com and click on fiction or original fiction. I think it'll take you straight there. You can download and read my books for free if you want to. That's it. That's it for me. Catch you later.